Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Roy Catriel. I'm here on behalf of plaintiff appellants Kathleen Conroy and Sheila Crowley. And at this point, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. We believe, Your Honors, that the district court committed reversible error in granting summary judgment to defendants 3M and Staples on all of the consumer plaintiff's antitrust counts. The district court acknowledged that 3M had already been found in the LePage's antitrust trial liable for unlawful monopolization of the relevant market for clear and transparent tape for home and office use, and that it had been found so liable by engaging in unlawful exclusive dealing arrangements and bundled rebates. Nevertheless, hearkening to the Illinois brick doctrine, the district court reasoned that we as consumer plaintiffs could not recover for any antitrust violations unless we first prove that defendant 3M and defendant Staples, as the representative of a retailer class, engage in a price-fixing conspiracy. But it's a conspiracy limited to price-fixing to the exclusion of all other types of exclusionary conduct. We believe that was error. And before I proceed to show why that is, I'd like to outline the 5 points of error, some of which collapse onto one another, that the district court committed. By the way, had the district court not committed that initial error, then we would have been entitled, arguably, to proceed against 3M directly. They, after all, have been found liable for monopolization, unlawful monopolization. And the only thing that prevented us from proceeding against them directly to recover the anti-competitive price that we paid was the imposition of the Illinois brick bar by the district court. The district court found that our evidence did not prove a price-fixing conspiracy and therefore dismissed all counts. The first point of error was the district court's invocation and decision to apply Illinois brick to this case, even though it is undisputed that there was no overcharge, much less an overcharge that was passed on to us as consumers. And plainly, Illinois brick only deals with that factual scenario. Where there is no overcharge, there is no danger of duplicative recovery, nor a complication of allocation or apportioning of damages between the direct and indirect purchasers. Second, once the district court decided to apply the Illinois brick doctrine to this case, erroneously, then it compounded that error we maintain.
Let me go back to that for just a second. Let me see if I understand. But your contention, though, is that the consumer, the consumer who buys the tape, is paying a higher price.
Well, it is, but to refine it more precisely, Your Honor,
ultimately pays a higher price.
Well, it pays a higher price, but why? Because the lower-priced alternative, the generic private label tape, mm-hmm. is now unavailable. Right? LePage's, the generic private label tape manufacturer, was excluded from the market. That was what was found in the Third Circuit case. Now, that means that our injury as consumers accrues once we are forced to purchase only the higher, more expensive tape. For instance, if somehow the oil manufacturers conspired with their retail gasoline service station managers to only stock premium gasoline, removing unleaded regular gasoline, your injury accrues at the moment that happens because now that lower-priced alternative is no longer available to you. And that's what we maintain happened here. One measure of our damages is that the day before the conspiracy to monopolize happened, we had at our disposal as consumers the ability to buy LePage's tape for a fraction of what the price was that was being charged by.
Well, at least with the evidence with respect to Staples, that one retailer, there were other lower-priced alternatives available.
Your Honor, the evidence with respect to Staples was that they had some...
I only mention that now just in connection with the price.
Right. And I'll get back to it, but to give you a sort of shorthand answer to that, the evidence with respect to what LePage's ended up stocking was a private label tape called Stockland. And the reason that that's not significant here is because it's not part of the relevant market definition. And the reason why it's not is because the Stockland tape, foreign manufactured tape, is a matte finished tape. It's not transparent. The LePage's jury found by its verdict on a special interrogatory that the relevant market only consisted of transparent tape. Now, the fact that they stock matte tape is of no consequence to us as consumers because we don't view that as substitutable. And that's not just some sort of conclusory assertion. The jury found that. They also stock paper clips and staples, real staples, other ways to affix documents. But if we don't view that as a substitutable product, then it's of little consequence to us that those are less expensive than the brand Scotch tape. Our injury accrued when the true substitutable product, the generic version, was no longer available, and it was no longer available as a result of 3M's actions.
As a result of the monopolization.
Exactly.
Of attempting to exclude LePage from the market.
Attempting to and actually achieving it, because they were found liable for actual monopolization, not just merely attempting.
I just ask you a question. Is it the court still has not received, the Supreme Court, a response from the government and therefore has not had the conference yet?
That's my understanding. I checked the Supreme Court docket yesterday. My understanding, and perhaps the 3M's counsel will be able to elaborate on that, was that it's been several months.
And they didn't give the government a date? They just said, we'd like to know your position if you ever feel like telling us?
That's, putting it charitably, that's how I understand it. But so far as I know, no Solicitor General brief has been submitted, and no decision on certiorari has been granted. And I think it's getting a little bit late in the Supreme Court term to see those briefs, but I think that's where we stand, unless the docket that I checked is simply incorrect. And if it is, I'm sure we'll hear.
No, that's what I understood also. But I thought maybe there's some sensible answer to this. But
now the second point, which I think ties into what Judge Pius was asking me about, the second point of error was this notion that the only conspiracy that would suffice for us to get over Illinois Brick was a price-fixing conspiracy. But I think, as my answer just illustrated, the reason we believe that was wrong is that a conspiracy to exclude a lower-priced competitor would suffice irrespective of any price-fixing. And you found as much just 4 months ago in the case that we cited in a Rule 28J papers, the Glenn Hawley case. It's the Glenn Hawley Entertainment v. Tektronix. There you agreed, and to quote your language directly, you said, if the antitrust laws are designed to protect customers from the harm of unlawfully elevated prices and from agreements between competitors at the same level of the market structure to allocate territories in order to minimize competition, here's the language of interest, it is no stretch to conclude that these same laws protect customers from harm directly related to the unlawful removal of a competitive product from the market. And by the way, that is also analogous to the Supreme Court's case on the exception to Illinois Brick. The leading case on that we cited was McCready v. Blue Shield of Virginia. That wasn't a price-fixing conspiracy. There the allegation was that the insurance carrier, Blue Shield, had conspired with the psychiatrist to exclude the psychologist from obtaining reimbursement and being covered by the insurance carrier. The consumer, much like us, sued, claiming that she was therefore denied reasonable access to a competitive provider, namely a psychologist, and that to do so she had to pay more. There was no price-fixing allegation, and the Supreme Court did not hesitate in holding that, nevertheless, Illinois Brick was not a bar. As a corollary to these 2 points of the misapplication of the Illinois Brick doctrine, the third point of error that the district court committed was that once it ruled that Illinois Brick applied, and that we could only allege a price-fixing conspiracy, it also held that we had to join the retailers as co-conspirators, which is how Staples came into the picture. It's held that absent joinder, we could not invoke that Illinois Brick bar exception. The problem with that holding is that, first, it conflicts with the prior decisions of this Court, namely Shamrock v. Arizona, which, by the way, was decided with a panel consisting of now Supreme Court Justice Kennedy. And the suggestion that in addressing the Illinois Brick Bar exception, Shamrock simply forgot to address the question of joinder is simply not credible. The whole point of that opinion was whether the Illinois Brick co-conspirator exception applied. And to suggest that a key element of that was joinder, but that this Court simply chose not to address that, simply doesn't pass the laugh test. You also, a few years earlier, reiterated that joinder was not necessary in the Inglis case, which we cited in our briefs. But the point here is not simply to look at precedent and to see if we can excerpt one sentence from here and one sentence from there as to whether joinder is required. The rationale behind joinder has to be looked at. And the rationale behind joinder is that joinder should be required when failure to join the middleman could lead to duplicative recovery and thereby lead to the dangers of Illinois Brick. That's simply not an issue here, because 3M concedes, and we maintain, that the retailers were never overcharged. They were given a discount, a rebate. Now, so there are only 3 types of scenarios here that could happen. A retailer could have conspired with 3M, met its quota, and obtained a rebate. Whether they're joined or not, they have no claim. They obtained a discount. There was no overcharge. A retailer could have joined the conspiracy, failed to meet its quota, and not received a rebate. They're still not overcharged. They're paying the same price for 3M tape that they paid before. They just are not getting a discount. But failure to obtain a kickback rebate is never an overcharge, particularly when the rebate is alleged to be unlawful in the first place. And the third is someone, a retailer who comes in and says, I had nothing to do with this. 3M never approached me or I never joined. I just continued buying from LePage's and from 3M. They're never overcharged. And what's more, they were never prohibited from buying from LePage's. So there is no point to joinder here. And again, if we didn't have to join, but for that erroneous decision, Staples wouldn't even be in this case, and our evidence would not have had to be pigeonholed into evidence only limited to Staples and 3M's dealings. After all, we're dealing with an antitrust violation which requires market exclusion as a whole. And to determine whether there's been monopolization and a conspiracy to monopolize and a conspiracy to exclude and a conspiracy to fix prices, we ought to be looking at what's happening in the market as a whole, not merely as to what's happening between 3M and one retailer. And the LePage's en banc decision cataloged that enormously and in great detail. And what's more, because I think I'm going to be hearing about this in 3M's opposition, let's disabuse this record of the notion put by 3M that LePage's was still available in any number of stores. Quoting now from ER 1237, which is the en banc opinion at page 31, although 3M claims that customers participating in its rebate programs continue to purchase tape from LePage's, the evidence does not support this contention. Many distributors drop LePage's entirely. And, of course, for antitrust purposes, the key inquiry is not whether some roll of LePage's tape was available at certain retailers at some place in undefined quantities. The question is whether LePage's was diminished from the marketplace to such a capacity so that it no longer posed any price-constraining competition. The fourth point, which I'll just summarize, is that irrespective of how you rule on Illinois Brick, and we contend that it ought to be reversed on that ground, the case should still be reversed because we have a claim for injunctive relief. In other words, if we can prevail in showing that these rebates were unlawful, then we have grounds as consumers to ask the court at the end of the trial to impose an injunction to prohibit 3M from continuing to engage in that conduct. And it's black-letter law that Illinois Brick simply has no application to injunctive claims under the antitrust laws. A similar corollary is that we have a claim under the Cartwright Act. And the Cartwright Act, by the terms of that statute under Section 16750 sub A, says that indirect purchasers are allowed to sue as well as direct purchasers. In other words, California state law does not follow Illinois Brick. The district court dismissed our Cartwright Act claim because it said we couldn't represent a national class. Fair enough. That's a basis perhaps to deny our motion for class certification or to constrain our class definition down the road. But it's not a basis to enter summary judgment, particularly whereas here summary judgment was argued before class certification. The fact of the matter is that Kathleen Conroy, one of the plaintiffs, is a California resident. She bought her 3M roll of tape in California, and she bought 3M tape. That qualifies her as a consumer purchaser withstanding to represent a class in California under the Cartwright Act. The scope of that class is to be decided on a Rule 23 motion.
All right, but you agree that Staples should be dismissed from the Cartwright Act, right?
Staples should be dismissed from the – well, we don't believe Staples should be in this case as a named defendant to begin with.
Well, they are, and
right.
Now, and the court dismissed them because he dismissed the Cartwright claim, but you're not opposing the dismissal of Staples from the Cartwright.
I am not, and the reason for that is that it is true that we have two plaintiffs, a Virginia and a California one. The right. California plaintiff
no,
not.
No, I understand the reason. Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
Counsel?
Yes.
Illinois Brick is aptly named because it's a brick case, and the brick cases are pragmatic. Now, let's assume that you have your class certified, and let's assume that you win a judgment of $300 million. Tell me how you're going to distribute that $300 million.
Well, the answer to that is dependent on what is the scope of the class that's certified.
Let's assume everything goes your way.
Sure.
There's no ifs.
No, I understand.
You got the money.
Right.
You got a class. You know exactly every name in the class. Tell me how you're going to distribute the money.
Our plaintiff was challenged, by way of answer to Your Honor's question, our plaintiff's standing to bring this claim was challenged because there was an argument that there was no proof that she actually purchased tape. She produced a receipt from Staples which outlined the fact that she purchased 3M tape. The reason for that, Your Honor.
How much would each member of the class get out of that $300 million?
Well, it depends on the quantum.
Just tell me approximately, your best guess.
Well, if the generic was being sold for 40% less than the premium, they would get 40% of their total purchases.
And then they prove their purchase.
Well, if they have receipts, they can prove them. And if you have institutional companies.
Suppose I bought some Scotch tape, mm-hmm. you know, from J.C. Penney or by a local drugstore.
Yes.
And how do I prove to you that I bought that tape?
Well, if you don't have proof, you may not be able to file a claim, but that's a matter of...
How could anybody remember that they bought Scotch tape at a certain time in a certain place for a certain price?
Well,
I'm talking pragmatic stuff.
No, I understand. And pragmatically, with respect to the plaintiffs that are before you, they do have receipts. They were part of the record, and they were introduced. Institutional clients, like hospitals, like law firms, like government entities, they have purchase orders and receipts as well. Not all the people who purchase are lone individual John Doe purchasers. And the retailers have records as well, because every time you pay with a credit card, those items are itemized in the credit receipt. That's all part of class discovery that we were planning on taking. Now, getting back to my fifth point of error.
What would be that cost of administering the fund? How much percentage would you get administering the fund?
Well, as I understand it, and the Ninth Circuit follows the lodestar approach, and part of the claim under the recovery under the Sherman Act that we're entitled to do is the attorney's fees that we've expended. And we would file a petition for attorney's fees upon being a prevailing party, and it would be up to the judge to determine, and she can make a reduction or an increase of that lodestar.
What do you estimate the percentage would be?
I have no idea, Your Honor, because this case was disposed of after 3 months of discovery. I have no idea how much more effort we'd have to put into it.
Okay.
But irrespective of the problem with administering the claims of the class members, before you are only two named plaintiffs. Both of those have receipts to prove their overcharge. And whatever the pragmatics of your argument and the appeal of those pragmatics of your argument may have as to the class, before you is an uncertified class, only two individual plaintiffs. And the question before you is whether they should be allowed to continue with their claims. Now, getting back to my